Research Theme Park is a magical place in the Carlette Psychiatry podcast that showcases papers that are practical, playful, and reveal a little bit about human nature. Today, we'll take you to a quiet place in the park, Medland, where the clinical trials that inform our practice take place. It's empty now, as a stay-at-home order has shut them down to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. All that's left are graphs and papers, and we'll pick up a few of the latest ones to share with you here. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psych NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
We start with two psychiatric updates on the coronavirus. Chloroquine may cause psychosis. Chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine have been used as anti-malarial agents for over 70 years, and lately they've created a stir as potential therapies for COVID-19. In bench research, that is, in vitro studies, they've shown an ability to keep the coronavirus from entering and exiting cells. What's more controversial is whether they will help in people like they do in the Petri dish. Chloroquine has already failed to live up to its in vitro promise with other viral illnesses, like the Ebola virus, chikungunya, influenza, HIV, and dengue. In the case of the chikungunya virus, patients had more long-term complications when they took chloroquine, possibly because chloroquine can impair immune functioning, inhibiting T cells and interleukins. So far, the chloroquines have small uncontrolled studies showing benefits against COVID-19 from France and China, and randomized controlled trials are being expedited. While we await those results, many people are already taking chloroquine for COVID-19, and Kelly and I have already seen some in our practice. As psychiatrists, there's a few things you need to know about the chloroquines. They have long been associated with psychiatric side effects, most notably psychosis, mania, and mood lability. Next, lithium goes up against the coronavirus in a new theoretical paper. Here's a little-known fact for these viral times. Lithium has antiviral properties against over a dozen viruses, and it has been used successfully as a treatment for herpes virus. Lithium improves immune function, but it also impairs a virus's ability to replicate. This month, a group of physicians in Poland put forth a paper suggesting that lithium should be studied against the current coronavirus, officially known as Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2. There are many types of coronaviruses, and so far lithium has proved effective against four other coronavirus strands in vitro and animal studies. While we await those results, remind your patients on lithium that viral infections are a risky time for lithium toxicity. They should stay hydrated, avoid NSAIDs, as those can raise lithium levels, and use acetaminophen instead for temperature control. And if severe nausea or diarrhea ensues, hold the lithium until those symptoms resolve.
Antipsychotic dosing. How high is too high? Despite decades of research, we don't actually know much about the dose-response relationship of atypical antipsychotics in schizophrenia. This meta-analysis set out to find the near-maximum effective doses for 20 antipsychotics, and they wanted to know if patients got better as the dose went higher or if their response just leveled off. The main result: most antipsychotics follow the law of diminishing returns. As the dose stretches beyond a certain point, the average patient doesn't get any better. They figured this out by graphing the dose response curve for each antipsychotic. Most of the graphs plateaued or became a bell-shaped curve as the dose went higher. The average maximum effective doses they arrived at were often a little below the maximum dose in the PDR. And here they are in alphabetical order. Aripiprazole, 12 milligrams per day. Acenapine, 15 milligrams per day. Brexpiprazole, 3 milligrams a day. Paliperidone, 13 milligrams a day. Quetiapine, 482 milligrams per day. Risperidone, 6 milligrams per day. Now, for the long-acting injectables, aripiprazole, 463 milligrams every 4 weeks. Paliperidone, 120 milligrams every 4 weeks. And for risperidone, 37 milligrams every 2 weeks.
While this paper concluded that going beyond those doses did not seem to make a difference for the average person with schizophrenia, this was not a hard and fast rule. For 6 of the medications they studied, the benefit seemed to keep rising as the dose went up. Those were iloperidone going up to and beyond 20 milligrams, lorazepam up to and beyond 160 milligrams, olanzapine 15 milligrams, paliperidone 13 milligrams, enzaprazidone geodon up to and beyond 200 milligrams a day. Certainly none of these are hard and fast rules, as they're just for the average patient in these trials. But these are good benchmarks to know, and they remind me of an earlier study a few years ago that found that when people with schizophrenia are treated with excessively high doses or excessively low doses of antipsychotics, they don't live as long. Topiramate is tested for compulsive shopping, but we're not buying it. Topiramate is often used in impulsive and compulsive disorders like gambling, binge eating, bulimia, OCD, binge drinking, cocaine and methamphetamine abuse, and irritability. Indeed, it has small controlled trials showing benefit in all of those conditions. This study tested it out in compulsive buying disorder, a disorder that's not in the DSM-5 but that you might see in practice because it's said to affect 2-8% of the population. But the results of this study tell us more about how to read a research trial than whether we should use topiramate in this population. It was a 12-week randomized placebo-controlled trial. Sounds good so far? 12 weeks is pretty long. Only 50 patients, though, which is a bit small. We'd like to see studies with 100 or more subjects. The main problem, though, is that the medication only made a difference on secondary measures. And that means the medication didn't really work according to this study. So why is that? Why can't we just count on the secondary measures? The tests we use in these studies are only valid in a statistical sense, which means that every time we use one, there's a chance that we might get a false positive. And the more times we run them, the more likely that chance is. Just like the more times you roll a dice, the more likely you are to roll double sixes. That's why we want researchers to name what their primary outcome is, so they don't keep rolling that dice. So, in the end, when you see things like a trend towards statistical significance or positive in secondary measures but not primary measures, it means that the study's kind of a wash, that if there is a benefit to this medication, the benefit is probably so small that it's not able to show up in the design of the study. So should we try topiramate in people with compulsive buying disorder? Well, the first thing we should do is rule out hypomania in those folks. But if we're left with nothing else to do and psychotherapy hasn't worked, we could consider topiramate. We just need to go forward with that honestly, knowing that it's not been proven to work and stopping it if it's not making any difference.
Compulsive buying disorder is not in the DSM, but here's the proposed criteria. 1. There is an over-preoccupation with buying. 2. The patient is constantly obsessed with buying, and they are always dissatisfied no matter what they purchase. 3. Compulsive buying is not limited to hypomanic or manic episodes. And 4. There is often distress or impairment as a result of the activity. Who gets better on lithium? This retrospective study of 900 patients from the Consortium of Lithium Genetics is one of the largest studies to date of lithium response in bipolar 1 disorder. Patients who responded to lithium tended to have more manic episodes than depressive ones. Their illness often began with a mania, and they had an age of onset between 15 to 32. They were more likely to have bipolar disorder in their family history, suggesting a stronger genetic influence on their illness. And this is all consistent with previous research, which has suggested that patients with the classic phenotype of bipolar, the textbook case, tend to respond better to lithium. Specifically, those who achieve full remission between episodes and have clearly separated episodes of mania and depression rather than a lot of mixed states tend to do better on lithium. Where this new study differs is that it found evidence that comorbid panic disorder predicted a good response to lithium. In older studies, multiple comorbidities and anxiety disorder predicted a poorer response to lithium. So, who did worse on lithium in this study? Those were the patients with comorbid OCD, alcohol or substance abuse, and psychosis.
We'll end on a study that suggests it's hard to tell when people are angry at you when you're taking a benzodiazepine. There have been a handful of investigations into the effects of benzodiazepines on social cognition, that is, the ability to read people's faces. The idea makes sense. Benzodiazepines act on structures that are involved in reading faces, like the limbic system, specifically the thalamus and hypothalamic tracts. This paper pulled 8 of those studies into a meta-analysis. They concluded that benzos do impair social cognition, but only in one area, anger. Research subjects who were given a short-term benzodiazepine proved less accurate at identifying facial expressions of anger compared to those who were given a placebo. The benzodiazepines did not affect the ability to read sadness, disgust, fear, surprise, or happiness, although there was a trend toward a deficit in those negative emotions, particularly fear. Anger is one of the most dangerous emotions, and it's possible that by turning down the limbic system's anxious reflex, the benzodiazepines are dampening people's reactions to the real dangers in angry faces. This deficit clocked in at a medium effect size, which means it's big enough to notice in clinical practice if you're looking for it. And maybe that's the point of this study. Few of us are looking for this, and yet it could have profound effects on our patients' relationships. Imagine if you were slow to pick up on the fact that your spouse is angry at you. It might be like having thick skin, or it could be that your spouse gets increasingly annoyed at your non-responsiveness until it boils over into a fight. The studies in this review used low dosages of benzos and short-term administration. There is only one study that assessed the long-term effects of benzodiazepines on emotion recognition, and it found that people who took benzos over the long term had difficulty reading negative emotions across the board, fear, sadness, and anger. SSRIs also affect the ability to read faces, but in the studies I'm aware of, most of which were done in normal subjects, they help people read faces more accurately. In one of those studies, they had people play a cooperative game in groups. The groups that had taken an SSRI could read each other better and were more cooperative, resulting in more wins.
Tune in next week where we'll go in depth on a serotonin receptor that keeps popping up a lot in some of the newly released psychiatric medications, serotonin 5-HT2A. As you exit the park, you will find some practical tools at thecarletreport.com. Today's visitors will receive $30 off their first subscription with promo code PODCAST.
You can find the references to all the articles we discussed in the show notes for this episode.